Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
Thank you, Corinne, for appearing with us today. A hearty welcome. We look forward to learning from you about a very pertinent, very important subject. I read an article of yours a while back and was so impressed by it that I wrote you afterwards to see if you might be available to participate in our webinar series. I was delighted that you said yes, and I look forward to joining many others in just a minute in learning with you and from you. Very briefly, Corinne Blackmer did her graduate studies at UCLA, taking her PhD there. She now teaches at Southern Connecticut State University. She offers courses on anti-Semitism, among other subjects that she deals with, including, interestingly, the Hebrew Bible. She's lived in Israel. She knows Jewish life intimately, is concerned about the appearance of Israel hatred and Jew hatred in communities that she's very close to. And I came to know her also after coming across her book, Queering Anti-Zionism, which is pertinent to today's subject. Corinne, I'm going to stop there and hand over now to you. Very much look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Alvin. I'm going to move this here over to the side so I can see fully my screen. So we can see here the title of this is Queer Anti-Zionism, Anti-Semitism in LGBT Communities Then and Now. Let me make sure I'm going here. So I wanted first to give a background of gay anti-Semitism. And in part because in the early days, anti-Zionism was not at all connected with gay communities. The man who invented the scientific study of homosexuality, Magnus Hirschfeld, was a gay Jew and a sexologist, and he worked in Weimar Germany before he was obviously shut down by the Nazi government. In addition, for his time, Sigmund Freud had very enlightened views about sexual orientation. He said the big question was, why aren't all people bisexual? He was very interested in bisexuality. At that time, Judaism was quite homophobic until the 1980s, when things began to change. Gays were almost as likely to identify with the persecution of Jews as that of other minority groups. Anti-Zionism was not associated with gay people, who began to identify more closely with Jews after Judaism, outside of Orthodoxy, began to eschew homophobic views of Torah, particularly because of their shared experience during the Holocaust. Now, the idea that gays had been persecuted under the Holocaust came to light in the late 80s and was then became a public symbol for the ACT UP movement, where you had the pink triangle that was what gays used to wear during the Holocaust or were forced to wear. So what happened to change this picture of amity between gay people and homosexuals? Three things: critical race, queer, and intersectional theory, which came into about 1989. There was a Black female law professor named Kimberly Crenshaw, who developed the legal theory that people with multiple disadvantages, Black, female, disabled, Jewish, feminist, here I put Zionist almost ironically because they never include it, lesbian, should be studied holistically and their experience analyzed in terms of how these embodied oppressions intersect. In other words, you should not just analyze how someone is female and oppressed, but female and Black. So you would intersect or combine their Black experience as Black people with their experience as women. And so you would get this sort of a holistic or accurate whole picture. Mm-hmm. And that she called intersectional theory. She went on in 1993 to craft critical race theory. Critical race theory basically, in the most clear terms, sought to explain why did Black people continue to have struggles despite the triumphs of the civil rights era. And she used two terms or two concepts. One was white supremacy and the other was systematic racism. In the meantime, queer theory, my third term, rejects traditional categorizations of sexuality and gender and strives to show the quote-unquote queer element in cultural and literary productions. That is to say, where things diverge from an ideal or idealized heterosexual or heterosexist viewpoint and seem odd. So you could analyze a lot of cultural and literary phenomena as something that was not quite straight. So what went wrong? What disabled this friendly relationship between gay people and Jewish people? So here I asked, what went wrong? Well, you made this huge jump from intersectionality, which concerned individuals who are multiply disabled or multiply oppressed, to deciding that you would have the intersection of movements, whole groups of people who were somehow involved in who were oppressed. And you made these wild comparisons. The first comparison that a woman named Angela Davis made was between the situation of Black Americans and the situation of Palestinians. And she did this in a book called, The Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement. And she spent her entire time discussing what was freedom as a constant struggle, what was wrong between, how these two movements related. Obviously, they relate very poorly, but that did not prevent her from pressing the argument. So she combines intersectionality with post-colonial theory, and it refers to the anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist socio-political theory that promotes boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and claims that all movements to end oppressions are essentially the same. There's no difference. And for her, they're just composed of the oppressed and the oppressor. So this black and white simplistic language can be traced back to Angela Davis, who's the first to deploy it. And she saw it through an intersectional lens, which is the oppressed and the oppressor. In this new intersectional approach, Israel became Exhibit A in the world of oppressive states, as thinking about social struggles became a binary that pits oppressors against the oppressed. This combination of queer critical race and post-colonial theory provided the intellectual framework that produced LGBTQ anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And you can see how that did it, but what happened was that Jews became outsiders and were outside this magic circle of the oppressed. Jews were seen as privileged white people who were oppressing oppressed people, the Palestinians. So Jews, suddenly history did not matter. They were super empowered white people. In fact, in many accounts, the very height of whiteness was to be Jewish. Other potential intersections of movements and real genocides, the Yazidi, Rohingya, and Uyghur Muslims, Darfur, Sri Lanka, Nigeria, Kenya, Iraq, and Syria, elicit no protest from any of these folks. Possibly and probably because they're non-Western, and possibly and probably because they do not concern Jewish people. They're non-Western, and because many of them are Muslim on Muslim, they're simply not going to discuss that. They have no vocabulary for that because that would be somehow Islamophobic. So all these major, huge, important genocides around the world are never discussed by these folks. Only Israel, Palestine. Therefore, Palestinians face the same oppression as Black Americans, and Israel practices pinkwashing. So we see this picture here of George Floyd, and it's on one of the barrier walls in Israel. I can't breathe, I just want justice. So what they did was they brought over the family of George Floyd to Palestine and made a big deal of the occupied territories, excuse me, and made a big deal of illustrating the similarities between their struggles. Brown Palestinians, brown I put in scare quotes for obvious reasons, face the same conflict with white Jewish Israelis as African Americans do with dominant white American society. Of course, in this scenario, Betta and his Mizrahi Jew, Israeli Jews, about 60% of Israel Jews are erased. They're inconvenient, although sometimes they're subjected to a rhetoric called brownwashing, by which Israel attempts to whitewash, as it were, oddly enough, to use that word. The presence of Jews of color, or excuse their action through presenting the truth, which is demographically, Israel is not a white society. All right, so of course, within this binary of oppressor and oppressed, the major defining differences between Palestinians and African Americans are elided. African Americans and Palestinians have a wholly different situation, socio-political struggle, history, and the like. And it's a poor and very, very awkward and inaccurate comparison between those two peoples. And you can only press it by saying that there, in every struggle, there is nothing other than the oppressed and the oppressor. So all complexities disappear. All real facts disappear. And from this comes their disinterest in facts and complexity. Okay, within this domain, Israel is guilty of pinkwashing, meaning it uses its stellar record of civil rights for LGBTQ people to whitewash its mistreatment of Palestinians. It prides itself on its treatment of gay people, and in that way tries to ignore or to erase or to marginalize their struggle with Palestinians. If this were the case, then I couldn't rag on New Haven for gay pride parades or the publicity we use for gay pride parades because we happen to have some poor neighborhoods. It would be an attempt to whitewash that fact. But this is argument, these are arguments used only in reference to Israel, this pinkwashing argument. Hence, we see pictures like this in the media, which is extremely prejudiced against Israelis. And I think we've all seen that since October 7th, how really biased the media is. Israel is the oppressor and Palestinians the oppressed. And nothing too much more need to be said about the situation than that, that Israelis are bad and Palestinians are good because they are the victims. Now we come on to how this affects gay and lesbian and queer Palestinians specifically, a Q question. To what degree do Palestinian and Israeli identities intersect? How are they related to one another? After all, both are gay. And the answer is the intersection of going in opposite directions. It's very hard to make comparisons between the two, other than to say that one group is experiencing a good social situation, and the other group is amongst the most burdened and oppressed gays and lesbians in the world, for reasons I'm going to discuss. The situation for Palestinian LGBTQ people is horrible. When we say recriminalize sodomy here, this is a picture from the West Bank, where there's been some lightening of the 1939 British rule about criminalization of sodomy. Sodomy is criminal in the Gaza Strip under Hamas. It usually elicits a death penalty. It used to be throwing, they used the same thing as ISIS did, which is you throw gay people off top of buildings if they're found out to be gay. Okay, so here's the kind of rules under which gay Palestinians live. Gaza criminalizes consensual same-sex activity. It's seen as an offense to Islam, a blasphemy. And on the other side of the land, in occupied territories, in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority police ban the activities of queer and feminist rights organizations. It's not quite as bad, since they have now, because of Rashida Tlaib, asked for them to be opened again. They did so. But they're very, very marginalized and are always subjected to police involvement and interrogation. Palestine in general, both the Gaza and the West Bank, has absolutely no civil rights that protect LGBT people from discrimination or harassment, which includes shunning, abuse, disfiguration by either knives or acid, and death threats. Honor killings occur regularly. So under these circumstances, in order to express their gay identity, gay Palestinians usually have very little op few options than to seek refuge in Israel, fearing for their lives, especially from members of their own family. And this would be particularly their brothers and their uncles and their fathers, but even more particularly their brothers and their uncles. Around 2,000 to 3,000 Palestinian homosexuals live in Tel Aviv at any given time. I should mention that when they're in the West Bank or Gaza, it is their gay identity that is salient. When they move to Israel, it is their homosexual, it is their Palestinianness that is salient, because there's always the fear that they are pretending to be gay, and they are actually terrorists coming into the country. So the Israeli police will hunt them down, unless they get involved with a Jewish Israeli person, at which point they can apply for status as a refugee, which they frequently do. And but they have to be involved with a gay Israeli Jewish person. They actually face some of the worst oppressions as gay people in the world. And if anyone's the victim of the conflict between Israel and Palestine, it is gay people. They're on the crux of that conflict. So here's a specific example. In 1920, excuse me, in 2022, a gay Palestinian man named Ahmad Abu Mahriya sought asylum in Israel because he was re receiving death threats. He was well known to be a gay man, and had been involved with both Palestinian and Israeli men. He was kidnapped where he was living in Tel Aviv, to the West Bank, specifically Hebron. There he was beheaded. The Palestinian Authority did go after the person who beheaded him. And I don't know what happened after that, whether this person was arrested or not. But his story is not unlike the story of thousands of gay people in Palestine. I should mention that outside of Ramallah, which is sort of a quasi-city, there are no cities in the occupied territories, which are usually requisite for gay people as places in which to hide and sort of operate more of a clandestine fashion, with sort of a multi-layered situation. So gay people in Palestine are extremely, extremely exposed. Every clan, every family knows everybody else, and it's easy to ferret them out. So they are not the only people in Palestine who are oppressed. Palestinian women under patriarchal culture, and also under the occupation, face violence, abuse, and second-class citizens as the norm. And we can see here these two Palestinian women sort of trudging along, bearing fairly heavy burdens. And that is symptomatic of the sort of abuse they face. Obviously, they have to wear the hijab, usually the chador. They have very few rights of any kind whatsoever in Palestinian lands. Now, I'm mentioning both those cases, both the beheading of the Palestinian gay man and the oppression, usually violent, often violent, of Palestinian women, as a lead up to what happened on October 7th, which was the unspeakable, unbelievable, and horrific rapes by Hamas of Israeli women, specifically of Jewish Israeli women. And there is no language to describe how horrible an event this was. I will note here, importantly, that this event was ignored by all major feminist organizations worldwide. And this was complained about. You see here the signs: "Unwoman, no excuse for your silence." "Unwoman, there is no excuse for your silence. Jewish lives matter." So there was, and then Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO, came out and said, "Why are we ignoring this? Why aren't we talking about what happened to Jewish Israeli women on October 7th?" It constituted one of the most horrific modern rape crimes of the 20th or even the 19th century. And I want to stress here that it was used specifically as a weapon of war. And to go back to the gay man, Ahmad, there is a war against gay people as well. It's not as nearly as brutal. It's not even close. I also should mention that on October 7th, men were raped too, by the invading Hamas. So they're not as badly. We don't know too much of the information there, other than men were raped as well. So finally, feminist Western organizations were forced to speak up and came to their senses too late. And clearly what happened was that they were at a knee-jerk response to saying, well, the only people who really matter are the Palestinians, Israelis don't matter. So Western groups, some of them, are abysmally ignorant. As we can see, this group, which is actually quite popular, Queers for Palestine, Really, most gay Western groups display abysmal and complete ignorance of Middle Eastern realities. What are the pronouns for queers in Palestine? Was, were. They don't are not allowed to survive or to exist. It's really a bad situation. But these queers for Palestine are all over the place and would be killed immediately if they step foot in Palestine. But still, they support Palestine. Now becomes the question of why is this going on? First, we need to contrast the situation for LGBTQ people in Israel. We have pride parades, you serve openly in the army as a gay person, and you can get married in a civil marriage. Religious marriage is not allowed unless you are an Orthodox person, basically, in Israel. It's all civil marriage. So, what rights do Israeli LGBTQ people have? Really, they are extensive, spanning everywhere to the right to employment protection, right to adoption, right of return, and right of inheritance, pension, and medical treatment. And they are your full panoply of civil rights are extended to LGBTQ people in Israel. The Tel Aviv Pride Parade is worldwide. It's an internationally renowned celebration. It is a popular gay tourist destination worldwide. And I'm sorry, I just noticed I misspelled destination. I apologize. And it attracts, what, 75, 100,000 people easily, much more than that, actually. And so you have this open celebration of gay pride. So how does BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, make this alliance between gays and Palestine? It's done through what I call here the pinkwashing cycle. It would seem to be a very hard thing to do. Israel is a very pro-gay country. Well, you do several things. You claim that Israel only supports gay people to cover up or whitewash its oppression of the Palestinians. You claim that Israel launched a marketing campaign aimed at burnishing its image to sideline the Palestinian issue. You make the really odd and unfortunately very, very inaccurate claim that Palestinians are not that homophobic. You accuse those who point out homophobia of Arab nations of Islamophobia or misunderstanding the sexualities of Arab cultures. This has been done quite extensively by a man named Joseph Assad, who wrote a book called Desiring Arabs, and Jasper Puar, who wrote a book called The Right to Maim. Finally, you claim that Israel only supports LGBT Jewish Israelis because of the pronatalist policies of the Israeli government. Everybody should be having gay babies, including gay people, so therefore they'll be given their rights. All quite insulting. So we see on university campuses the breeding or the encouragement or the ideological brainwashing of the next generation. Well, gay students come to university with several reasons that they are influenced by this. May often they're rejected by their families. They have a sense of social isolation, sense of ostracism. They are actively recruited by pro-BDS groups promising inclusion and acceptance. I put asterisks after the ones I thought were particularly important. They simply don't know anything about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They are ignorant about the history of Israeli LGBTQ rights and culture. They are the black and white thinking of the intersection of movements is appealing. It's easy. You can see just two sides of anything. Sense of in-group solidarity and common cause. and after a safe object on which to project homophobia. And they're simply unaware that in opposing Israel, they're jeopardizing their interests as LGBTQ people. Conclusion: education is what is crucial here. Intersectional of movements has become a potent weapon. Pinkwashing is a potent weapon. Because of prejudice, ostracism, and isolation, LGBTQ students are low-hanging fruit for recruitment by pro-BDS groups. Pro-BDS student groups and women's studies programs promote fierce hatred of Israel, also other ethnic studies groups, and now it keeps on being extended. The once upon a time distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism has evaporated, with anti-Zionism the most dangerous form of Jew hatred today. What do I suggest? Educate, 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 and use humor to diffuse propaganda. And so I want to end with something here, and that is, humor. Oops.
Yeah, everyone has group sex in Tel Aviv during Yom Kippur. The shofar isn't the only thing getting blown. My deepest apologies to Dr. Guy Nadeev. Just because you're a veterinarian, I shouldn't have assumed you're into puppy play. I'm sorry for constantly trying to instigate a rivalry between Moron Gil and Alon Shabo. Your bakeries don't need to be at war with each other. There's enough bored mothers who like cake in the afternoon for the both of you. I just love rivalries. Next year, it's going to be the Challah Prince versus Jake Cohen. And I'm very sorry to Niv Nesseen and Aviv Grinberg for ruining your first wedding the other day when I got up and said, "Don't you love me now that I'm thin? Can't we be together now that I'm thin?" over and over again. I thought the joke would land, but I guess your family didn't really like it. And I'm sorry to Lior, Nadeev, and Guy for that party I threw when your thruple broke up. It's just that you rubbed it in our faces so much on Instagram. So it was kind of fun. And I'm very sorry to the Kadarafa gay men's volleyball team for calling you soulless steroid abusing fuckboys. That wasn't nice. You don't take steroids. I hope you'll forgive me, power gays of the Viv. Now, the real question, when are we getting our apology from Amir Ohana?
Okay, so that's a very good example of using humor to diffuse